House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, we had one carryover item on House Bill 4041, which has to do with the policy statement. I'm going to ask our esteemed staff to read it to us and see if there are any additional comments or concerns about it. If not, we'll send it on. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, after several iterations, we've come up with a draft of a policy statement that would be appropriate, and it reads as follows. The purpose of this tax expenditure is to extend property tax benefits to Indian tribal governments for providing government services equivalent to those provided by other governmental entities. Additionally, the expenditure encourages the provision of housing to low-income individuals while achieving consistency in the administration of property tax exemptions.
All right, so you've heard it, and I think you've received it by email. Is there anything additional about it? If I don't get an additional comment, I'm assuming that that's what we're going to send. Okay, that's what we're going to send. Thank you very much. With that, we'll open the work session on House Bill 4110. There he is. There he comes.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is the bill we heard last Friday, and I think at that time there was certain discussions of some of the either maybe a proposed amendments or not, and I think you have in front of you now that we just received today the fiscal statement from our fiscal office, and this is a statement that you just got.
Yes.
Is there a revenue statement?
There is no revenue impact.
Okay.
So in that sense, you don't need a revenue statement. The fiscal statement basically keeps this in verbiage mode until, of course, the thing that they have at the bottom recommending that it should go to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right. Yes, Representative Ayer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. We mentioned here the $136,000 each biennium of the cost, and that was exactly what Mr. Salvaggio testified at $68,000 a year. But he sent up a follow-up email. It was just slightly different in 70-something thousand. Is that material enough to have to change this? Do you recall that? So I just want to raise that just to make sure that we're accurate. It went from 68 to like 100 or 70 something each. It was like 5,000 or 6,000 difference each.
I think Mr. Salvaggio, this is probably reflective of what the fiscal office have received from the state treasurer.
Okay.
So that and if there are other things at that time. So in their sense, it is not necessarily a budgetary line item because they think that this would need some further analysis, obviously. That's the way they would write the verbiage for a fiscal when they think it needs more work. So this is the indication.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, now this bill on its face doesn't have a fiscal, does it? I mean, the bill itself says that if there's a fiscal,
it would only require a treasurer to adopt and would have minimal fiscal.
Okay. So they basically said there is no fiscal so long as the treasurer follows what's in the bill. Have I got that correct?
The bill, Mr. Chair, the bill says that unless there is an appropriation through the Ways and Means process for the state treasurer to implement, then the whole thing stays dormant in the statutes.
Right.
So in order for things to start acting and working in the same way, you need to have a clear appropriation from Ways and Means to the state treasurer. That's why if you don't, then it stays in without being activated, if you will.
Right.
And therefore, no fiscal. That's correct.
Right. So it becomes a policy of the state that isn't actually implemented because because the funds to do it are not available.
That's correct.
And the bill itself says that.
That's correct.
Okay. Yes, Representative Berger.
Are you ready for a motion?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4110 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Co-Chair Berger moves House Bill 4110 to the floor. This is without amendment, yes?
Yes.
Yes, without amendment with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to state on the record the point that I appreciate the intention of this bill, and that I think to the extent that the bill has an effect, that effect is intended to be confined to those businesses doing investments in the energy sector, which has been the shield for the alleged nuclear weapons program, that this bill is not a statement in any way against Iranian people or Iranian citizens, that it is directed at the regime and at their bad actions within the international community, and that it is directed at those businesses that are directly supporting the sector of their industry that has been connected to their alleged nuclear weapons programs. But it is not a statement against the citizens or the people of Iran.
Yeah, thank you. Further discussion? I would simply note in support of Representative Bailey's comment that that a scrutinized company, according to the bill, is a company that currently has made an investment in the energy sector of Iran, as described in, and then describes some additional issues. And I think that's what you're referring to, isn't it, Representative Bailey?
Correct, Mr.
Yeah,
Co-Chair.
Thank you. Anything else? Is there any objection to the bill going to the floor with a do pass recommendation? I don't hear any. All right, with that, the bill, the motion carries, and the bill goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Who is carrying? I'm assuming that the co-sponsors would like to carry it. Unless I hear otherwise, we'll assign the two Representative Greenlick and Representative Widener to carry the bill. And they're not here, so if that turns out not to be accurate, we'll reassign it. Okay. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4110 and open the public hearing on House Bill 4079. Chris.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And it wouldn't be a session without the discussion of energy-related tax credits.
We would hate to have a session in which that didn't occur. Yes.
So House Bill 4079A does a number of technical clarifications to the bill, House Bill 3672 from last session. And in your packet, you have the SMS from the House Energy, Environment, and Water Committee, and a fiscal light and a revenue light. There isn't expected to be any revenue impact because these are technical changes. You also have in your packet a cheat sheet, if you will, that I put together entitled House Bill 4079A and Potential Amendments that I can either go through in detail if you feel like punishing yourselves, or I can just highlight a couple of key things if you'd like at the chair's pleasure.
Now, just so I understand, the cheat sheet starts with the A version and then considers additional possible amendments. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. That's why the title is Potential Amendments. It depends on the committee's pleasure. But the way it's laid out is identifies the bill section and just the change that's in that bill section and the credit that it's related to. And anywhere on that left-hand column where it says amend would be what is in the potential amendment.
I got you.
So these would be additional changes beyond what are in the bill currently.
Okay. And these are amendments that you have in your possession?
No, Mr. Chair.
Or items of discussion in the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water?
These are things that arose after it was making its way through that process.
I got you.
So I have been in contact with the Ledge Council, so they've started drafting some of these, but there are a couple of points that would need some policy direction to finalize it, so it didn't seem worthwhile to have an amendment that wasn't quite ready to go.
Okay.
And so I could just talk through the amended pieces or the potential amendment pieces.
Representative Berger?
It would be my pleasure, Mr. Chair, if he would just go through the sections and sort of clarify the policy decisions and what potential amendments are contemplated, if he could.
I think that would be excellent. Do we have witnesses signed up on this bill?
There weren't any signed up a few minutes ago. The Department of Energy is in the room.
Well, then we'll take our time and go through these, and that may prompt some amendments or some discussion.
Yeah.
Some presentations.
Okay. Just working through here, the first few sections relate to the renewable energy credit. And this is all clarifying language. I think the committee had discussed these before during the legislative days in January. Mm-hmm. So a couple of changes since then would be in the amendment section. It would state clearly that these credits, once sold, they could not be revoked. And part of the issue here was these are credits where certain parties buy the credit and then the money is used to fund other projects. So there is no reason to revoke it. The person who buys the credit, there's nothing they can do or not do that would cause revocation. This is in the language here. This is one of the credits that's sold by auction, and there's language that states that money could go into this same fund via an appropriation. So one of the changes here is to clarify that the fund could receive some money from the credit and some money from the appropriation. And there was concern and confusion around the possibility that an auction would be held, the credits would be sold, the assembly would then appropriate money to the fund, and then all of those credits would have to be revoked or rescinded and refunded, which is not the most efficient way of processes. So there was a lot of trying to figure out how to clean up that language, and so what we're looking for in the amendment is just a clear statement saying once the credits have been sold, they can't be revoked.
Okay.
And that sends also clarity to the market for these credits that, okay, I bought the credit, they can't be taken away.
Right. Point of clarification.
Yes, please, Representative Bailey.
And just to clarify that once they're sold, this means that it's not that they can't be revoked in terms of a grant from the fund to an end user, but in terms of the actual tax credit for the individual that comes in and purchases them who is not connected to the project development. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Third-party purchaser.
Right, it's a third-party purchaser, and they have nothing to do with the project, so there's nothing they could do or not do that would violate the grant agreement. That's a separate party, and this language doesn't touch the grant recipients.
Okay.
Another change here, there was on the jobs data, there was concern about the requirement to collect a lot of complete jobs data, both direct and indirect. So the compromise that was reached in the prior committee was that the job data collected would be for direct jobs only. That minimizes the cost to the taxpayer or the person, the project holder, as well as collecting the most pertinent of information for tracking policy purposes.
Mr. Chair, I remember a discussion of this. It's sometimes onerous for someone receiving this grant to do an entire study of all the effects of, you know, they can count how many jobs they've got, but how many their vendors have, and on down the line gets. And we don't want a complete economic study with every applicant, so this was...
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
And which one are you referring to now?
This is still all the renewables.
Well, we're still talking about Section 1, or Section 3.
Yeah.
Four.
Yeah, that was Section 4.
Four.
These are... I'm trying to highlight things that have changed or modified a little bit since the January discussion.
Right.
Okay, so that's it for the renewables piece. In the transportation... The language around the five-year credit, as you'll find in Section 6, and this didn't get quite completed last session because the phasing down of the transportation credit presented certain obstacles to how that language would be worded, And the way it's worded there in Section 6 is that once the credit, now if you recall in the transit credit, it phases down and goes to 25%, 20%, and so forth. And so the way the phase out of that credit works is once you get to those lower credit percentages, less than 35%, the latter years of that credit are what get eliminated first. The 30, if you recall, the 35% structure goes 10%, 10%, then 5, 5, 5. And so that's how the phasing down of the amount of the credit and the time period fits together. Then in the amend piece there, the delete section 7.3b is just language that doesn't really do anything in terms of clearing up the definition of a transit project. It says a transit project is in a certain type of entity that was already excluded in the bill from last session. So it's kind of redundant in that way.
Oh, okay.
So there's
it's a cleanup.
It's a cleanup. Doesn't serve any purpose. Another piece here in Section 8, you have the jobs data issue again. The expiration date there in Section 8, you'll see some language that's deleted that talks about when the credit expires on 7.7.1.14. That language exists currently in two places, for the transportation credit and the conservation credit. It's deleted in that section, but it's being added to Section 16. So it's not actually being deleted from statute, it's being moved. Okay. And that just clarifies that for the old Betsy program, Section 16 pertains to the old Betsy program. And so it just clarifies that all of those credits, pre-certs that were outstanding when the project or when the program ended, have an absolute expiration date of 7/1/14.
Okay.
Yep.
And then getting down to Section 10 and the two amends there. And this is one of the cases where we're still trying to come up. You'll see a blank percent there. This is where some policy direction is needed. The issue here is with the cap on the program, the department needs authority to manage that cap. The expectation is that the demand for the credit will be greater than what was allowed, and so they need some authority to manage the cap. And what exists in Section 10 now is a proportional reduction. And so the complication that arises is for the transportation projects, you basically have two kinds of projects. You have transit projects, and you have the alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure projects.
Right.
And with just the way the department is managing that at the direction of the legislature is to set aside some money for their alternative fuel vehicles and the rest for transit. With language that limits their authority to a proportional reduction, you can have a case where the demand for the alt fuel vehicle is sufficient. I mean, the supply is sufficient to meet demand, but the demand for the transit exceeds the supply. And so they would have to proportionally reduce all of them, both the transit and the alt fuel vehicle, when in actuality they only need to reduce one of them. So under those two amend lines, there are two pieces that could be added. One would be to prioritize the alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure and basically say, okay, well, you're proportionally reducing the transit, but you don't have to proportionally reduce the old fuel. Mm-hmm. And the other piece here pertains to the logistical mechanism of how the credits are allocated. Mm-hmm. And the discussion has been basically on prior use of the credit sets the distribution, if you will, for how the limited dollars get distributed. Well, there are a couple of entities that receive a very large share of the credits in the past, and they would likely eat up the lion's share of the new credit. So one potential way to handle this is to say that any one entity couldn't receive more than X percent of the pot, if you will.
And you could do both of those things, couldn't you?
You can do both.
Yeah.
You can set it both up so that it's going to be a proportional reduction, but once you hit, say, 15%, 20% of the total, then that's all that entity can receive. And as you can gather by the blank percent, that is...
But what I mean is you could prioritize alternate fuel vehicle infrastructure.
Yes.
And limit the size any one entity could get.
That's correct.
If you wanted to, you could do.
Yes.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Correct.
Yeah. Do we know, did the other committee get information that would tell us what the relative size of these things are? I mean, I'm assuming that alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure individual items are relatively small items, and therefore the applicability of this statute would be fairly small, but that a transit system issues would get very large very fast. I don't know if that's really true, but that's my assumption. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. I think that that assumption is probably true. I think the other portion here was trying to get at the ramp down effect that this committee discussed for transit providers that I think from the discussion from last session from the Tax Credit Committee was that I think we were interested in having a phase out essentially of this tax credit mechanism to fund transit agencies, and I think that this was to recognize that perhaps that the ramp down would apply there first, as opposed to on this what is really a separate animal, this alternative fuel infrastructure.
Do we have amendments in process around this? How are we going to get at the policy decisions that are in this amendment proposal?
On this particular one, I have been in talking with Kate and Ledge Council so that the language can be there, so she could think about how
then we
that should
can,
be drafted.
We can discuss.
And I've also been talking with Department of Energy about the data behind what that percentage would be, because 10% is very different from 80%,
right.
One could imagine.
Right. It takes an economist to understand.
Yeah, right, to figure it out. Well, and I'm really aware of the fact that we need big pieces of this bill, and we have 2 weeks to get it through the House and the Senate.
Yeah, so, okay.
So we're going to have to move along. Okay. Go ahead. Are there other alternatives that have, it feels to me as though these are fairly clumsy ways of getting at this issue. It may be the best we can do. Are there other ways that have been discussed for getting at this particular problem?
Well, outside, you run into a situation, there's, on one extreme, there's the authority that the Assembly would grant the Department in terms of allocating it, leaving it up to, they can get into it and you can hand it all over to them and then they can figure out how that works. Or you can, how much of control do you want to, how many sideboards do you want to put on it for them to work with him? And the percent, you can go for a dollar amount. I mean, they're only, the cap is $20 million for the biennium, so there's only $10 million in each year. And as Rep. Bailey noted, it changes each year because the transit is being phased out. So on that phase, more money will be going to alternative fuel vehicles, which was the policy that the committee envisioned last session as that technology starts to grow and to help that provide the appropriate incentive there. So you could go to a dollar amount or percentage amount, seems to hold it fixed over time and put kind of all of the entities on a similar glide path down or ramp down.
Okay.
But those are the trade-offs.
All right, let's go ahead and finish this, and then let's figure out today how we're going to try to manage this so we can get this bill underway quickly. Go ahead.
The next group is the residential, and I don't think there's anything new there from January.
And so the material's in the bill?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, material's in the bill.
Okay.
Biomass, in Section 15, there is language that would eliminate potential double dipping, so to speak, for oilseed processors. The amendment is that statement there that's in quotes, and is just, it does two things. It accomplishes that same goal for oilseed processors and codifies an energy rule that limits the double dipping for everybody. So the language is a little bit broader a little cleaner to achieve that purpose.
Okay, so that's in rule now, and the idea is to codify that rule.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that in doing so accomplishes the oilseed processor.
Yeah.
Section 16, I mentioned earlier, that's the Betsy, and that would contain this language that does two things. The phrase that remains outstanding as of 7/1/11, that is just the pre-certs that were active that were outstanding on that date.
You took out over there.
And also clarify that this expiration date of 7/1/14 does not apply to the manufacturing, Betsy.
Okay, and that requires an additional amendment, or that's already in the bill?
That requires an additional amendment.
Okay. Yeah.
We think it's in the bill, but it's better to be clear.
Yes. We've already figured that one out on this issue, haven't we?
Well, and the committee has gone a long way in dividing this up into separate credits so that such confusion is minimized in the future.
Okay.
Good job. And then the next group is the manufacturing, Betsy, and there's nothing new there. Oh, the only new thing here in the amendment is there's a reference to the Department of Energy, and that needs to be Business Oregon because they now own that credit.
And that's in 18, is it?
Yeah, that's in 18.
Okay.
You'll see a reference to the Department of Energy there.
Oh, yeah, line 23 on page 16.
So agency needs to change.
Yeah.
The next section is biomass, and section 20 has a cap for the program. What you'll see in amendment is a removal of section 20. So there will not the cap that currently exists in 4079A will not be there.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Comment on that. There is as the committee will remember, there is not a pre-certification process on the biomass tax credit. And just to point out that the reason for the removal here is that there is no ability to manage to a cap if there isn't a pre-certification process. So just wanted to get that on the record.
Should we have one?
Maybe a larger issue that violates your direction to hurry up, Mr. Chair.
I wish it was up to me. No, actually, I don't. I'm referring, of course, to President Courtney's well-known views on the subject of hurrying up. Yeah. All right.
Okay, the next block is the conservation credit, and all of those, there's nothing new there. Everything's already in the bill, and those issues have already been discussed in other credits. And then the last section here is the addition of the credits to the transparency website. And these are the transportation credit, the renewable, the credits in discussion here get added to the transparency website. Two changes, potential changes in the amendments are in those reference, you'll see a reference to credit 315.236. Which is the credit for the renewable energy grant program. And there is arguably not much value in having those tax recipients' information on the website. They just bought the credit to fund the fund, for the money to go into the fund. So Ledge Council is tying the grant program connected with that credit to be the relevant information for the transparency website.
Mm.
So it shouldn't be the credit directly. It's the grant recipients who receive funding as a result of tax credit 315.236.
Would it include the amount of the credit and the amount of the grant?
It could. It's just as I understand it, the intent of the transparency website, there isn't any value in having the recipients of that credit associated with it because they don't have to have anything to do with renewable energy.
Okay.
And the other piece for the RETC, which is 316.116, a couple of issues came up. Now, as you recall, that program substantially changed in 2012, and there are, up through that point, there had been a lot of claimants for very small credits. The appliances was kind of the big issue there. So the way of trying to provide the relevant information without a lot of unnecessary small detail would be to provide two restrictions on that credit, and that would be having the credit be worth at least $2,000 and for tax credits issued in 2012 and later years.
Yes, sir.
The purpose here is to make the transparency website less effortful. Is that, in other words, keep it to things that have more relevance and therefore less work required on the website?
Sure, Berger, I think that's a fair characterization. I mean, otherwise you can get a lot of people who got $100 credit, $50 credit, And that's one kind of thing as opposed to some of the larger credits that the state grants.
Those all disappeared, don't they? The small ones after 11?
Not all of them.
Okay.
So that's why the two-tiered approach.
Now, Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think also going forward, the intention is that we're not imposing this retroactively on somebody who didn't know at the time that they bought their dishwasher that the fact that they got a $50 credit on this was going to mean that their information was on a website somewhere. So it'd be nice to not surprise those folks.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's
effective date?
Well, each of the sections, and kind of at the bottom of each block, there's the applicability for each of the sections,
right.
And it's either, generally speaking, it's tax year 2011 or tax year 2012, depending on the credit. And the effective date is just 90 to 91 days.
Right. The standard reference to it for an item that deals with revenue.
Right. Right. And I guess I should add the sections 5, 11, 14, 19 and 23 are the applicability sections for different pieces, and those vary between tax year 2011 and tax year 2012. They mirror the applicability of House Bill 3672 for last session.
Okay. So, colleagues, we're in public hearing, but it seems to me this is a good time if people have comments on these ideas to get them out there so that we can give some guidance to LRO about amendments. Let me ask if it would make sense to establish a work group to work with LRO on these amendments. If that makes sense, and if so, who might like to serve on that work group? Yeah, I figured. I figured it's the three of us. Anyone else? Yeah. Okay. Four. Is that acceptable to the committee that we do it that way with Representative Bailey, Representative Berger, Representative Barnhart, and Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, you need someone with a last name that doesn't start with B.
Yes, you're correct, and I think we've got that. Yeah, all right. Last chance for public hearing. Yes, Jody? I shouldn't have asked, should I? Please, go ahead.
I fell asleep on the bill last night. So, to those of you on the small work group, may I suggest a few things? Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So, it still seems that the 75% of a project can be public subsidy is pretty generous. That means that we could give $250,000 of public funds to a project that had only $80,000 worth of private funds in it. We would get no equity. And that's a pretty generous approach to use, and we should be considering whether we have the assets to be doing that for private business. Also, it's not clear, would funds from the Energy Trust of Oregon be counted as other government incentives or grants? Is that another government, or is that just something that we set up as the government? And I think that bill should be clear about that, because if you could have 75% from the state and federal government and also have energy trust money, that could be leaving a very small percentage for the private investors. Also, there's a five-year time horizon for a project to continue operating. And I think that was put in place originally because that's how long the tax credits were going to be. You know, they were spread over 5 years. But it seems like if we're supposed to get our money back, we should be expecting something to be in operation for more than 5 years. That time horizon should be 15 or 20, not five. And it should include a clawback. On that moving of the auction date to April 15th from December 31st, I think that might make it easier for people to decide to buy at the auction, because they would at that point know what their taxes are likely to be for many people. And it also gives them another chance to try to sell the $1.5 million worth of tax credits they currently have. But it is an odd change to be making, and it's a change I think you should consider. I think it might make better sense to just put it in the budget. And if you put it in the budget and you took out the advantage that the taxpayer gets by purchasing these tax credits, you could say, well, it's going to be 5% plus the hassle at the department to handle the auction. And so instead of having a $20 million limit, you could have a $19 million limit and use that other $1 million to keep the low-security jail. That was what it was going to take to keep it open for another 2 years. So, you know, there are other ways to use the money, and that would simplify the process of these subsidy, shouldn't say tax credits, and make it easier on the department, make it clear what we really are doing, and it could be at lower cost to get the same amount of benefit out in the field. I think it's excellent that you've given yourselves the opportunity to reduce or eliminate this program and to warn people of that, because, of course, there's always that claim that you shouldn't be suffering these programs when, in fact, we're cutting all sorts of other programs through our budget process. That's on page 3. Another point is there are numerous places in this bill, page 6, 7, 17, and 18, I believe, the only ones where you refer and are changing the requirements about job reporting. We recently got a D- on job reporting from Good Jobs First, and I think that this bill still leaves us not making a distinction, some really important distinctions, like what's the difference between a construction job and an ongoing job? You know, a construction job is maybe worth one-tenth of an ongoing job or one-fifth of an ongoing job. Should all be reported, I think, in FTEs in that way. There's also a distinction between retained jobs and created jobs. If you've got new jobs, it's quite different than if you've just moved jobs from one facility to another facility. And that distinction is not information that's being collected. And we're also collecting no payroll information. If you're asking for the FTEs, you can easily get that from a business's payroll records, and the salary they paid is right there beside it. And so you could easily calculate whether these jobs in any one of the facilities is actually lowering the per capita income in that county or raising the per capita income in the county. And then there are two points in the bill where you're asking the department to do proportional allocations if there are too many applicants. And as I recall, in the last session, we talked about the department using their own good brains to figure out which projects that come forward, if there were too many of them, they would fund. Because there is a significant difference between good technology and bad technology, many permanent jobs, few permanent jobs. And if we just do proportional passing out of money, we might end up with almost all the money for biomass going to one county instead of being spread throughout the parts of the state that might have biomass facilities, for instance. And I think that's the kind of thing. We have a department that has intelligent people working there. They care about what's best for our state, and we should be giving them the latitude to actually use their judgment instead of us just saying do this proportionally. And I don't understand why on page 15 the prohibition against applying tax credits to prior years has been removed. That's all I have.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. As always, we appreciate your inputs, and hopefully you help us make our bills better. Appreciate it. Department of Energy, have anything they want to add today? Nobody's moving, so I guess not. With that, unless there's something else, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4079, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1529. Property taxes. Here we come again. Good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1529 would kind of reshuffle a lot of the classes for which various types of properties are categorized under. And essentially, the measure would change revenue through the mechanism of changing the changed price ratio. And this ratio would be applied to any new construction or improvements on existing construction. And so by recategorizing various types of property, it can affect revenues by affecting the changed price ratio. You can see there the revenue impacts are positive, and in 11-13 they would be $150,000 all the way out to, by 15-17 they would increase up to $1.4 million roughly. The measure would also clarify language that some language, and it would establish, it would change some collection proceedings for machinery and equipment that previously would only be the option if it became delinquent would be to foreclose. And with this measure, the assessor would have also, or the county would have the option to allow for a warrant and seizure of machinery and equipment if the account becomes delinquent. So that is a change.
Before they can put it in a truck and carry it out of the county. Yeah. All right. That's it?
That's it.
Great. Thank you. We have Drew Hagedorn and Steve Wells. While they're coming, is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Okay. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing today on behalf of NAOP, the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties. We're the industry association for commercial real estate developers. As your staff indicated, this bill, which was unanimously approved by the Oregon Senate, relates to the assessment of certain commercial real estate properties. It is the work product of an interim work group that met after the adjournment of the 2011 legislative session that included commercial real estate developers, the Department of Revenue, as well as the County Assessors Association, in particular Multnomah County, were involved in the development of this issue. You may recall, it didn't reach this committee, Senate Bill 811, I think it was, or 808 perhaps, last legislative session. That was when NAOP originally introduced this concept. I talked to a couple of you about that bill in 2011. That bill wasn't ready for prime time, and so that's why we had this interim process where we gathered data from most of the counties to craft this proposal that's before you today. And at its core, I think Senate Bill 1529 is intended to address an unintended impact of a Department of Revenue administrative rule that was implemented and sought to create greater uniformity in the assessment of commercial properties county to county in light of Measure 50. When that rule took effect sometime in 2008, it resulted in substantial increases in the assessment of certain commercial properties, and most prominently commercial real estate warehouse space, excuse me. That increased tax liability resulted in a lack of parity between existing properties, that is properties developed before the rule, and properties coming on the tax rolls after the new rule took effect. This disparity created a competitive disadvantage for new properties because of the increased tax liability, and also created a significant economic disincentive for industrial development and job creation. So that's the public policy that we're seeking to address here. With your leave, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn to Steve Wells, who's going to walk everyone through the basic components of the bill. You have in your materials a PowerPoint presentation. It sort of draws the distinction between existing law and what this bill does. It goes through some of the data and so forth. So with that, I'll turn to Mr. Wells from Trammell Crowe.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am from Trammell Crowe Company. We're a commercial real estate developer nationally and in Portland, and we are testifying on behalf of ourselves and on the NAOP, which is the National Association of Industrial and Office Parks.
And just for the record, would you state your name again?
Yes, Steve Wells.
Thank you.
I want to run through four sort of basic sections, some background on Measure 50 that probably won't be news to anyone, but just to make sure that we're speaking the same language. The 2008 changes and how they affected warehouse and light industrial real estate, an overview of the bill, and the CPR impacts that would result from it. On page two, the background of the deal, Measure 50, as you know, limits the growth of properties assessed value of any one property's assessed value to 3%. And that created a concept of maximum assessed value where the maximum value could be different than the actual real market value. The growth in values for investment property has been greater than 3% for most of the time that Measure 50 has been in place, except the last few years. And that's resulted in a widening of a gap between the market values and the assessed values. The assessed values on commercial properties and investor-owned industrial properties are much lower typically than and the assessed values are much lower than the market values because market values have grown faster. Measure 50 provides a change property ratio, which is intended to create fairness for new properties that come on, because anytime a new property is built or it's rezoned or something and that or comes out of deferral, that property has to go on the tax rolls. And in order to keep it at in the same general tax range as a similarly assessed property next door, they apply a change property ratio to the real market value to get a similar assessed value relative to value as the existing properties. And that CPR is determined annually as an aggregation within a class of all the properties within that class. So I've put a chart on page three that sort of shows that graphically. For any one class of properties, you have on the left side a bundle of individual existing properties. They each have a real market value, and they each have a maximum assessed value. The counties make classes, and they add all those up, and they come up with a aggregated property class. And then they take that maximum value divided by the real market value and determine a CPR. And then for any individual changed property, they apply that CPR to the real market value to get the assessed value when it comes on the tax rolls. And page four in 2008 the rule change, and I should say before the rule change, some of the counties recognized that there are two different kinds of industrial property. There are industrial properties like warehouses and light industrial properties that trade in the investor market and are generic. They tend to inflate in value just like office buildings and retail buildings. Then there's state appraised industrial, big, which I would call heavy industrial or manufacturing plants that tend to depreciate in value. And so there, some of the counties recognized that that was a mismatch in the way they looked at classes for Measure 50. And Multnomah County is an example. They never put those generic warehouses and light industrial properties in with the state appraised industrial because the manufacturing plant CPR will tend to stay at one, whereas in the appreciating investor type properties tend to have this much lower CPR. Some counties didn't do it that way, so there was a mixed bag. DOR changes in 2008 caused everyone to have to group all the industrial properties together. And so what it did is it had a dramatic impact in some counties on the CPRs for new warehouse and investor industrial property, meaning that the taxes on a new warehouse went up dramatically versus the same valued property next door. This has a significant negative impact, we believe, on industrial development, job creation, economic development. Our economy needs a vibrant warehousing and light industrial sector. In fact, Portland is a very strong light industrial economy, and so we think it has a negative impact on Portland's economy overall. If you go to page five, this is just an example in Multnomah County of a hypothetical investor-grade industrial project. Before the 2008 method, a $20 million project would have had a CPR of about 0.4883, which would have given an assessed value of $9.8 million. Under the new methodology, that would have been an industrial classification and would have gotten a CPR now of 0.8376, resulting in a value of $16.8 million. And that $9.8 million assessment is also not just what a new property, but it's probably indicative on average what an existing property that's been there for many years would have been assessed at. So this results in a 71% higher tax rate on similarly valued new building and newly constructed building and existing building in Multnomah County. And this is a huge detriment to expanding that market and expanding users in that market going forward. On page 6, an overview of the bill. We believe this bill addresses the problems that came from this DOR change. And I'd note two things. There's two pieces, the assessment changes and the collection changes. The assessment changes only affect assessments on changed property. They don't affect any already assessed existing property, assessed properties, unless they've changed to the extent of that change. Machinery and it would do really several things. State appraised industrial, which is what I call heavy industrial, would move to a separate class where I think it really belongs by its nature. Remaining industrial property would be combined into commercial to create a class, and I think those two run very well together. They tend to act the same way from a value standpoint, which would essentially solve the problem we've described. The effective date is for this 2012 tax year. It's not retroactive. It doesn't create a whole lot of going back and telling people their tax bill's now changed, so there's no complication there. From the collection standpoint, I missed a bullet point. Machinery and equipment. In addition to heavy industrial, machinery and equipment would also have its own class, and it tends to do the same as industrial. It tends to depreciate over time, not appreciate. And I think it belongs in its own class. From a collection standpoint, this would identify any property that has separately identified machinery and equipment. It would allow county collectors to use personal property tax collection methods as well as real estate property foreclosure on machinery and equipment, but that M&E will still be considered real property. And that's effective 91 days after it passes. Two last slides. On page 7, there's a graphic that kind of describes the tax collection changes. Under the current plan, if you had an owner of a building and that owner was different than the tenant in the building, but that tenant had some separately identified machinery and equipment, you've got your orange and your blue pieces here. The tenant's M&E, if they don't pay their taxes, is subject to tax foreclosure only on that property. And then the owner's piece is subject to tax foreclosure on the owner property. In the proposed scenario, you would potentially have three different pieces. You would have the tenant M&E, which now would be subject to personal property tax collection methods as well. And then you might have two elements of owner property, the main real estate and their own separately identified machinery and equipment. That owner M&E would also be subject to personal property collection methods. But just to make it so the counties don't lose any strength that they had to foreclose, you could still foreclose on the base real property if that owner M&E went into tax non-payment. And then finally, on the last page, we've given of the responding counties, not every county responded, but of the responding counties, this is what we've been able to gather through the agencies as what the industrial CPR and commercial CPRs are before the bill, and then the combined, the last column is the combined industrial and commercial CPR. And our goal was to have the industrial properties be fixed, but not have the commercial CPRs change too much. And we think if you run down this list, you'll find that that's true. For instance, in Multnomah County, the industrial CPR right now would be 84%. The commercial is 49. If you combine them, it's about 52%, which really solves the industrial problem, and it doesn't really make that much difference. I develop commercial properties too. I'm not concerned about a few percentage points difference on a new property. It's that 70% difference that is concerning. And I think if you look at Clackamas, the commercial CPR doesn't change at all. Washington. The industrial CPR goes down to 73. The commercial goes up a little bit again. Lynn, similar situation. So that's the end of our comments. We would ask you to consider this bill and hopefully pass it. We believe it's good for our economy and for the real estate business. So.
Yes, Representative Reed.
If you're ready for questions, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please go ahead.
It's probably only me, but on page 6, I was having a bit of a hard time understanding how the last two bullets on your assessment changes fit together, not retroactive, but returning assessed values. Could you help me understand that, please?
Okay, so it returns the assessed values for changed property to a similar place where they were before the rule. In other words, it lets them be treated before the rule. A new warehouse property after it was assessed and brought on the rolls, was in kind of the same, a relatively even position with existing properties of the same. After the rule, that wasn't the case. So it fixes that. That's what I mean by returning the assessed values. The effective date is just the date that starts to occur for changed properties. Thank so it doesn't change any. It doesn't change any existing properties assessment in any way. It's maybe a wrong way to word it. So
I think I understand it now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you have others?
That's it for now. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, please, Representative Iyer.
Thank you. It's okay. I'm particularly interested in the tax collection changes. So let me just verify my understanding. So currently, tenant machinery and equipment is always separate from the owner of real estate's interest. And then if the owner happens to own both the real estate and the machinery and equipment, the tax foreclosure process was always available for both the real estate and machinery and equipment. Did they have cross lien rights, though? So the machinery and equipment, if there was a delinquency on that, were they able to foreclose on the real property? And if there was a delinquency on the real property, were they able to foreclose on the machinery and equipment under current law?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I may, Randy Walruff, the Multnomah County Assessor, I think is quite expert on this issue. He helped us craft this language. So with your permission, maybe we could call him up to the extent that Steve would like some backup here.
Yeah. Please.
I would say this to the extent that, well, I'll just let Randy answer that question. He'll do a better job than I will.
If you'd state your name for the record, thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Randy Wall from Multnomah County Assessor and Tax Collector, representing Barnhart, representing Ayer. To answer your question, prior to this bill, if it passes, real property machinery equipment only has one collection technique. It is real property. Only the property is the security for the taxes. So we go through the normal foreclosure process that we go through for any other real property. That's different than business personal property. In business personal property, it's also an obligation of the owner. So we can collect either on the property or against the person that owns the property. So in personal property, after the property becomes past due, 30 days after November 15th, if they haven't paid, we can send, and we do in Multnomah County, not all counties have this ability, to send notice of intent to warrant. And then if that doesn't trigger payment, we can actually record a warrant and then go after the techniques of garnishing bank accounts and those types of things to get the money for the taxing districts much sooner than you would under real property. In real property, we go through the three-year foreclosure process, and then it's typically 5 years out by the time we can go out and seize that equipment. The problem with that is many times that equipment is depreciated, it may have moved, and so you have two categories here. If it's a tenant in a leased building, we're out trying to foreclose on equipment, but the person that owns the equipment doesn't own the building. It becomes problematic. And I think someone referenced it earlier to getting a truck and hauling it off. That's a problem for us from a collection standpoint. And if the owner of the equipment also owns the building, then currently that's all on one account. So when they do not pay they don't have an option not paying the machinery equipment versus the building. It's all one account. We keep it as separate components within the account, so the whole account becomes subject to foreclosure. What this bill does is, in order to make it work to accomplish what the proponents want, machinery and equipment needs to be split out onto its own account so that the CPR calculations will work correctly. So it's created a situation where we do already have machinery and equipment on its own account if you're a tenant. We do not have the machinery and equipment on its own account currently if you own both the building, the underlying land and buildings, and the equipment. This bill creates a machinery and equipment account for all machinery and equipment, regardless of whether you are a tenant or you own the building.
Okay. If
Please, go ahead, yes.
Thank you. So now we're moving machinery and equipment to a separate class and treating it akin to personal property. Under the personal property approach of collection, if we have the real property element under this bill, the real property element, the taxpayer's delinquent, but they're not delinquent on the machinery and equipment being treated as real property, because it's, again, the language, I just want to clarify, can the delinquency on the real property allow collection on the machinery and equipment through the warrant process, or does it require foreclosure of the machinery and equipment?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Brewer. I'm going to try to rephrase your question and see if I understand it. Are you asking if the real property, if the owner did not pay their taxes on the building and structures but had paid their taxes on the machinery equipment account, then we would, our foreclosure action would only be against the building and the structures and the land underneath. The account that has the machinery equipment is paid.
Just to clarify and follow up.
Yeah.
So I just want to clarify, in Section 5, in subsection 2, it talks about, I believe that's where it is, in the foreclosure process, it says about the machinery equipment and the real property, if they're located and owned by the same person, that whenever the taxes on either the machinery and equipment or the real property are delinquent, you can foreclose on either. I want to make sure that a delinquency on the real property doesn't allow the warrant process to collect on the machinery and equipment for delinquency on the real property. I want to make sure that the reverse is not true, that it only applies perhaps in a foreclosure process, which is a right that currently exists without this change.
The way this is worded here, this has to do with keeping the real property foreclosure techniques that are currently in the statutes. Okay. So I hope I didn't misspeak earlier. If you're going to use the real property collection techniques and you are going to collect on the real property, then you would be foreclosing on the entire property. But when we talk about the personal property techniques, those would be separate, and those would only be used if the machinery and equipment account itself is delinquent.
And not real.
That's correct.
Okay. So to boil down then, what the difference between current and proposed is that we are, one, segregating out the machinery and equipment that is currently classified as real property, and two, we are now allowing the warrant process to for a collection avenue rather than just foreclosure on that machinery and equipment, whether tenant or real estate owned. Either way, that we're now allowing that process to happen.
Yes, that's
basically what we've done.
You've characterized that correctly.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Berger.
If I could comment, this is why people rush to this committee.
We have a huge demand here, don't we? Yes.
I'm astounded at the people that are back there listening.
Wow. Yes. Well, other questions, comments? I'm looking at the revenue impact statement, and the short paragraph in the middle of the first page on that says, because of its smaller amount of machinery and equipment and less depreciation, the commercial class tends to have lower CPRs. By combining the commercial class with the industrial class, CPRs are raised for this group, and this is a source of revenue gain. I will admit that my head hurts as I'm trying to figure out how a bill in which all you do is reclassify property makes a difference in the value of new property being put in the assessed value of new property being put into service. That's basically what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes.
Could you go into that in a bit more detail as to how that actually has the effects that are described on page 2 of the revenue statement, in which it basically shows that locally assessed industrial property values decline a lot in the new values, but commercial state-assessed industrial, machinery equipment, industrial, machinery equipment, commercial, when you add those all together, those are all positive, you end up with a substantial increase in the net value. And all we've done is recategorize things, and that's how it works. Please.
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee. Christine, I know she might be able to even answer this question better than I, but I look at it as you have one small group with a lot fewer new properties coming on the roll, coming down, and a very large group paying a little bit more. And that outweighs the reduction in the small group. So in the end, I've listened to the testimony, and just from my approach, the same thing, you scratch your head. The industry is sitting here. They want this. They feel it's going to help them for development, and it increases projected revenues, and it solves a long-time problem that assessors and tax collectors have seen in collection and in the tipping point between making a call on is something commercial or is it industrial. And I'll just add that in our county, I've had somewhere between 30 and 40 appeals in the last couple of years it's that inflection point that we're talking about, and this also takes that off the table.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I mentioned some of the stakeholders we worked with. We did reach out to a broader set of industry stakeholders than just the NAOP folks. I've been authorized by representatives from the Building Owners and Managers Association, Associated Oregon Industries, and the Port of Portland to indicate that they're supportive of this concept as well.
Great. Yes, Representative Ayer.
Thank you. Just one other thought that came to mind here. So because we have, currently we have the, under the current law, we have the machinery and equipment treated as real property with the real property. Now we're going to segregate that machinery and equipment out. However, by looking at Section 6.1b, it's clear that if that machinery and equipment is sitting on real property and it goes delinquent, that lien attaches to the real property. So my question then, following that, assuming that I'm correct in my read of that, are we going to see an expansion of definition of machinery and equipment so that, or in practicality and application of an expanded, applying it to a broader case of assets, having them treated as machinery and equipment? Do you anticipate that, or will this in no way change what assets are in practicality being classified as machinery and equipment?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Ayer. My answer to that is I don't see any change. The Department of Revenue has a very detailed rules explaining exactly what is to be categorized as real property, machinery, and equipment. And remember, if we did not classify it as real property, machinery, and equipment previously, then it was business, personal property subject to these same collection techniques and actually the same change property ratio, which is 100% is where that's at right now. Additionally, the courts have helped define over a number of cases over a number of years specifically what is real property versus personal property. And so while a good question, I don't anticipate that being an issue at all.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, my position, and of course if we get to a work session on this, I would like to clarify for the record that, in fact, if there is any additional rulemaking or anything, that there be no change to expand the definition or applicability of what is this real property, machinery, and equipment from what is currently being practiced, just for the record.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm sorry, Representative Gelser was next. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then I'll get another turn later, unless you ask my question.
I could try to read your mind, Mr. Chair.
Please, go ahead.
I won't hazard there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was visited earlier today by someone from the League of Oregon Cities expressing some concerns about the bill, and I wondered if we were going to hear from local government about this. And secondly, just wanted to make a comment for the record that this is just one of many examples of the maze that is our completely nonsensical property tax system, and I hope that we will have the will to really attack the problems in that system, to start to untangle it and put it together in a way that actually works for our local governments and our school systems. Measure 5 and Measure 50 have really visited unmitigated damage to our local governments and particularly to our local public schools. And if we move on this legislation, I hope that it would not make us feel like we have done enough to address this problem of our property tax system overall.
Thank you. I appreciate the comment. I personally happen to agree with it. When I try to explain to our citizens what the rules are, most of them very quickly give up and just assume that I'm way too wonkish and we want to go on to another topic.
And Mr. Chair, just to put that in very clear perspective, just as you may have a commercial property with machinery that's paying more than another with a similar value, we have homes that sit right next to each other that have exactly the same value, and there are tremendous differences in the tax that is paid on those two homes. It makes no sense, and it's not fair.
Yeah, that's true. The question I had was, what are your colleagues, what have you heard from your colleagues around the state from the other counties on this issue? Do they support the view you're expressing, or do they disagree with it?
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for that question. It was one I wanted to answer before you asked it. The Assessors Association is neutral on this. They didn't take a position in favor or against. The comment that they've officially made through Annette Spicker, the legislative chair of the committee, is that this is a better bill and easier to implement, albeit still with some work for us, than the Senate Bill 818 that was brought forward in the last legislative session. And so we were part of the work group. This is simpler and easier to implement, but it does involve some work for assessors' offices to separate these accounts out, and a number of us have been preparing for that and doing the groundwork for that, as I believe the Department of Revenue has too.
Thank you. Anything else for this panel? I think the Department of Revenue wants to be heard, so we'll let them come forward. And I'm assuming one of the questions he's going to answer has to do with statewide assessed property, but...
Thank you for your time, Commissioner.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And colleagues, Co-Chair Berger and I have agreed that we're not going to work the bill today. We'll hold the work session over until Wednesday at least. And let's hear from Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I think the proponents of the bill have pretty well described what the bill does, and you've captured that. I just wanted to say that I was one of the ones that spoke out last session about Senate Bill 818, because what we have and have had for a long time is the ability to class property on general large categories. They're not precise. They don't even bring reasonably similar things together, other than you might have a funeral home with a Burger King and a Home Depot. That's commercial class, for example. But what it gave us the ability to do was what the big challenge is. How do you appraise a million-plus properties every year? You do it on a mass appraisal system, which means you develop large classes, and from that class you propose trends, and you apply those, and you do some selected visits, and that's how you do it. That's what we've been about, and that's what the counties have been doing. So that's why the rules talk about how properties are classed. Now, Measure 50 came along, and Representative Gelser hit on it exactly. Measure 50 came along and said, but we'll co-opt the classification system, and we'll say new properties are going to be taxed and that their maximum assessed value is going to be created based off of this classification system. And we'll call that the changed property ratio by class by county. And so all of a sudden, our classification system, which we use sort of in the background to develop market values, was now makes an actual difference to people who are buying property or speculating or considering building here. It also makes a difference to, as Representative Gelser said, people who just happen to remodel. All of a sudden, their value on their home is different from their neighbors, and it maybe looks like the exact same house. Or properties that burn and rebuild. You'll see a bill maybe later on that. So there's all kinds of reasons why we have non-uniformity in the system. And this classification system, it has been, like I said, co-opted to do that. So last session's bill would have had us change our classification system to make it work for how properties are taxed, when that would have really frustrated our ability to value property on a mass appraisal basis. So what all I was involved with was to say, look, let's just separate the two issues, fix this problem, and this does fix the problem that I think the proponents are seeking, and without frustrating our ability to mass appraise property. So We think that it just deals with the classification. It pulls machinery and equipment out to its own class, and that is the fix. We don't think it affects how we value property or the unit of property or any of that. So that's what I was just here to reassure you that our rule, while it did frustrate people, it wasn't intended to have any effect on how they're taxed, but we had to manage how we were valuing property because counties were treating a distribution warehouse in one county different than they were. It was commercial in one county, industrial in another, and we needed some uniformity for the taxpayers in that vein. So those are my comments.
Okay. Question? Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps a question that's even a little too philosophical, but we're in that sort of a conversation now. At what point, is there any way to answer your question about at what point classes get too narrow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, I think when you get, no, but I might recognize that once there's a class for every property, we've gone too far. We're fastly approaching that with specially assessed property. There's going to be so many specially assessed properties that there are no normally assessed properties. But it's just a function of how much your system can manage. You know, you got Lane County that's in Curry County, and you've got some other counties that are suffering to even accomplish the current responsibilities, much less add a unique twist to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anything else?
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? If the rumors that apparently one of us has heard are true, that some other government entities have problems, I'm hoping that they will come forward quickly, because I expect that, I don't know what where the rest of the committee is, but I expect the bill is likely to move pretty soon. And as I indicated, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1529, and note that our current plan is to work the bill on Wednesday. We'll post for as a carry forward for Wednesday. I'm not certain that that's actually going to happen, but I think you should be prepared that that may very well happen on Wednesday. Anything else, Paul? We're ready. Wednesday at 1 o'clock. And the committee's adjourned.